Today's edition of Focus is devoted to answering your questions about pet care. Summer means hot weather and ticks that can get on your pet and spread disease, not just to your pet, but to you and your family. So today, we'll be talking about ticks, fleas, and other parasites and how to avoid them with Dr. Sally Foote, a small animal veterinarian in Tuscola. We'll also talk about pet food. Does it matter how much you paid for it or how little? Dr. Foote will discuss finding the balance between price and quality and whether table scraps are okay. I'm Jim Meadows. Dr. Foote will be answering any other pet questions that come her way, too, on this Pet Care edition of Focus. Our program begins after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and today's program is devoted to pet care advice. And we welcome your phone calls and emails on this Friday morning, August 2nd, for Dr. Sally Foote. She's a small animal vet from Tuscola. She specializes in dog and cat behavior. And Sally, welcome back to Focus.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And you can call us at 333-9455 or call 1-800-222-9455 if you're outside the 217 area code. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. And you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. And Sally, I'm wondering, with summer in full force, not as hot or as dry as last year, but definitely summer, are there certain cases and ailments you see with animals that match this time of year?
We have been so lucky this year that the weather has been a lot more, you know, moderate. And so it has saved us from a lot of the heat stress and overheating and, you know, problems related to that. But one thing that we are seeing right now is ticks. I mean, fleas are picking up, but this has really been a big tick year. And even on my own garden the other day, I was just, you know, having to pull a bunch of weeds because we've had a lot of rain and it's shooting up, you know. And I found one on my own, you know, chin and in my own backyard in town in Tuscola. So I have not seen too many tick-related diseases, meaning the diseases that the tick carries. Still, even just seeing ticks, you want to immediately, you know, get on top of having protection on your pet. And even for yourself, being aware that there are more ticks just out if you go hiking, say, at Kickapoo State Park, you know, or even in your own backyard, that you yourself are putting on maybe some insect spray and things like that.
And I'm wondering, because ticks, well, certainly you don't want to have them anyway, but what sort of diseases are we in danger of possibly spreading? Either to our pet and maybe also to us in the household.
Well, a lot of these diseases are ones that are not typically, you know, thought of right off the bat. Of course, many of us are aware of Lyme's disease. And Lyme's disease is a tick-borne disease. It's carried by the deer tick, which is different than the larger, much more visible ticks that we're used to seeing, like the dog tick or the American wood tick or the Lone Star tick. But anyway, Lyme's disease, many of us are aware of. It is more prevalent in northern Illinois than central, but we do have it here. So that's one thing. And then other diseases, it's called ehrlichiosis, anaplasmosis, Rocky Mountain spotted fever. There's a couple other ones. These are blood parasites that are carried by the tick. So when the tick bites and actually starts sucking blood and transferring, that's how they can transfer that disease. And that disease can then go into your dog or your cat, or into yourself.
Okay. I guess there are two things here. First of all, the preventive aspect. Mm-hmm. What do you do to keep ticks from getting on your pet?
First thing is to use a flea and tick product. Now, one thing I have to say is make sure you double check with your veterinarian what product, specific product, is best for your pet. There are those that are available over the counter that are actually very poisonous to cats, while they may say it's label okay for cats. You know, the Frontline brand is the most safe for both dogs and cats. There's Frontline, Frontline Plus. There's a generic equivalent of that. It is not absorbed at all in the body, and even if a cat grooms it off itself, it's not going to harm them, and it's very effective at killing ticks as well as fleas. There are some other brands also carried. Vectra 3D is highly effective. It's available through your veterinarian. Revolution is another. That's a prescription product that not only kills for flea and tick, but also prevents from heartworm disease for both our dogs and cats. But I have seen cats poisoned by some of the over-the-counter medications, flea and tick medications and products that they may say they're okay for cats. Or people are putting it on the family dog, you know, it's labeled only for the dog, and the dog and the cat may sleep together. It may rub off on the cat, and then the cat grooms it off themselves, and that's how the cat gets poisoned. So before you put anything on your pet, really please call your veterinarian or a veterinarian. There's a lot of people who haven't even taken their cat into the vet. But, you know, between the front office staff and that, we don't want to see your pets getting poisoned. Please call, or you can even check, you know, some of our clinic websites as to what's safe or not.
Now, as far as removing ticks, first of all, are you going to know if your pet has a tick on him or her?
You know, no. You oftentimes don't, because before they've become swollen up, you know, and big and fat from sucking the blood and that, they're very small. So what we sell at our office, you can buy them at a pet store. It's called a flea comb, which is a very finely tined comb you can comb through your pet, which will trap and pick up, say, the fleas and ticks before they latch on. Secondly, most often the ticks are going to be on the lower legs or around the head, ears, and neck area because, you know, a dog or a cat is sticking their head down into the grass, which is where most of the ticks are waiting, you know, on the grass for when they put their head in. And then they'll catch on the hairs and then climb up the hairs and latch on. So around the ears, around the face, around the neck is a good place to check. And you need to really part the fur and go through your pet. So after they've been outside, go through them and using a flea comb, or you can use a tick removal type tweezer kit like people use for themselves to remove the tick.
Are dogs going to sit still for that?
You know, a good dog will, most will, and like I recommend to my clients is go ahead and give them some treats as you're combing through and make it good for them. You know,
is a cat going to sit still for that?
Same deal with the cat. A cat can. Again, get a little dish of tuna. You know, make it good for them to sit still while you are combing them for ticks. I mean, really, if you make it good for them, you're not spoiling them. You're asking them to be patient. I mean, if I had to sit down with my daughter and run through her hair, I should let her watch TV or something, you know.
What about if you have to remove a tick? Will they sit still for that?
If the tick has not engorged to become embedded, yes, they will. In which case, you want to take a pair of tweezers and, you know, pull the tick off. And then I recommend clients to first put a dab of alcohol on the tick because it can kind of stun the tick and help it to not be crawling and moving around as much and pull back kind of its mouth part a little bit away from the skin. And then using tweezers to pull it off. And then for crushing it, to put it in a tissue and crush it with the tweezers. We do not want you to crush it with your hands because, again, the inner contents of the tick, if you have like a nick or cut on your hand, could expose you to some of these diseases that the tick is carrying.
Okay. It's pretty careful stuff. There are times when you have to bring the animal in.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not unusual sometimes for a client to say, I don't know if he's got a tick or not, and we'll just say, bring him in. We'll check him over for you. We'll take care of it. And that's like our service. That's what we do.
Okay. Let's take a caller now all the way from Des Moines, Iowa. Kelsey.
Wow.
Good morning. You're on the air on line one on Focus.
Hi. How's it going?
Fine.
Good. Well, my question is about I have a Morkie, and we are getting a lab puppy today. And so I just was wondering if you have any advice for the best way to introduce a second dog to an existing dog home.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your question. This is a good one. A lot of people are, you know, add a second pet, and especially when you're bringing in a puppy, and we're bringing in now a large breed puppy to live with a small breed dog. So, excuse me. First of all, whenever you have more than one dog, you want to have what we call privileges of rank, meaning that your Morkie is going to always be the dog who gets fed first, petted first, out the door first. You know, everything goes to that dog first. She is going to be number one dog because she's the dog who has lived the longest on that property, on that area. And so she's queen bee, dog to dog. And so with your puppy, then you will feed your puppy second, etc. Second of all, with this kind of, we now have big dog to little dog starting here in puppyhood, you're going to need to give your puppy a lot of playtime, walking, and aerobic exercise away from the Morkie so that when your Morkie and your puppy are together, your puppy is not bowling over literally and being really super rambunctious with the Morkie. And because, you know, it's a puppy and he's going to grow bigger than the Morkie within 2 or 3 weeks. The other thing you also want to do is really focus on teaching your Morkie to, like, come away, practice some come and call with your Morkie, because if the Morkie, sometimes little breed dogs will bark or even try to nip at a big breed dog as a way of saying, like, just before you get started, stay away. And we don't want your Morkie doing that. So we want to teach your Morkie, like, you leave the puppy alone, you're a good dog for doing that, and I'll get puppy over here and play with puppy. I think on our website at okavetclinic.com, we do have a lot of information about, you know, bringing a new dog into the home and on puppy care, et cetera. So that can give you a little more information.
Okay, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much, Kelsey. That's always a little delicate, I guess,
yes.
when you're bringing in a new animal.
Yes, and you know, especially when there may be like a big size difference. And sometimes people find it kind of funny that, let's just say, the Chihuahua, you know, is ruling the roost with a Great Dane living in the house. But it may be that, you know, the Chihuahua was there first, and the Chihuahua, you know, because they're there first, is really, really the head dog. And for dogs, no matter what their size is, it's just dog to dog, you know, how we get along and what we do. And so you want to support that in the right way between the two dogs, and you'll have much better and safer, you know, dog interactions.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're live talking about pet care on this Friday morning, August 2nd, with veterinarian and cat and dog behavior expert Dr. Sally Foote. You said Oka, what was the name of the website that you just gave a couple of minutes ago?
Oka Vet Clinic. So that's OKAWVETCLINIC.com.
Okay. I have a drsallyfoot.com here. Is that also
Yeah, that's a second website that I also have, that I do a lot of professional speaking and writing, and I do have other articles on that. For kind of the last question relating a lot to puppy raising and rearing and such, I have a bit more on our clinic website.
Okay, so look for okavetcare.com and okavetclinic.com. Mm-hmm. But also drsallyfoot.com, and that's with a silent E at the end of foot. Sally's ready to answer your questions about pet care when you call 333-9455, or if you're outside the 217 area code, call 1-800-222-9455, and you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. And the phone number again, 333-WILL. Or 1-800-222-WILL. I was wondering, we've talked about ticks and to a certain amount about fleas. Are there any other insects that are going to bother a pet when it's outdoors?
Yes. We also see biting flies and mosquitoes. And the biting flies are more of a problem is when we have a lot of fruit dropping off the trees. So when the mulberry trees, you know, were dropping a lot of their fruit kind of recently, and sometimes as we get into early fall while it's still warm weather, or we may have, you know, some hot days, kind of Indian summer days, and if you have, say, an apple tree or a pear tree or a peach tree that the fruit is dropped on the ground and is starting to rot, then we get a lot of flies. And if your dog or your More dogs are a problem with this than cats, per se. But anyway, if your dog is, like, laying underneath that shade tree, you know, to get cool, and the flies will start swarming around kind of their ears or around the corner of their eyes and such and bite and create a lot of sores. So the tips for that is to get a fly repellent ointment, and you can apply that to their ear tips and to around the ears or around their nose. If there's anything more involved, like around the eyes or other areas, you know, consult with your veterinarian. And then, of course, keep the area in your yard cleaned up of the rotting fruit or other debris, which attracts the flies.
And I'm just thinking that some of the places which may be most attractive to insects may also be most attractive to your dog or cat.
That's true. Yeah, right, because they may want to go sniff and investigate or possibly eat the rotting fruit and other things like that. Lastly, we have a lot more mosquitoes. Please don't get sloppy on heartworm prevention. Heartworm is a disease spread by the mosquitoes. It causes a worm in the heart. It can kill dogs. Yes, we do see heartworm in the cat. So there are monthly tablets or liquid products applied to the back of the neck that do need to be given every month. And they not only protect our pets from the deadly heartworm, but also from intestinal worms, which are more easily spread between pets and the soil, et cetera, in the summer months.
Are you seeing at this point any animals that have the diseases that fleas and ticks and other insects carry? Or are you just seeing them suffering from the insects?
More suffering from the insects, because a lot of these tick-borne diseases, especially, they may not get sick. Like Lyme's disease takes 2 to 5 months before you'll see the clinical signs after the bite. So we may not see like an anemia unless right then they're covered in ticks, you know, an anemic from the actual biting and sucking from that. But because if, say, they have anaplasmosis or leukosis, and the problems that causes may take a couple months to develop. So we may not see the disease problem until like October or November.
Okay. And that is that something that happens on a regular basis, that you see ailments a few months after when the weather gets colder and the insects aren't there anymore, but maybe
they're... Right. Yes, we do. Yes, we do see that. Like when we see what we, you know, let's say I see an animal coming in anemic and they have no platelets, which is, you know, a part of the disease process of some of these tick parasites that get on the red blood cells, and it's November, the first thing I may be thinking of is let's screen them for tick-borne disease. Or even if, you know, especially if they're in a very critical state, we may just automatically start the antibiotic, you know, treatment regime for a tick-borne disease, because it may be a day or two before we get the results back and we can't wait for that result. You know, we're just going to say, you have a pet, they're in the environment, right or wrong, we've got to start, you know, some treatment here for them. And that
some people are just going to wonder, especially if things get complicated, you know, can I afford all this medical care?
Yes,
true. For the pet.
I mean, yeah.
We know what a trouble it is for human beings getting medical care. I don't know what the scale of expenses can be.
Veterinary care is about one-tenth, literally. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, if you were to think about what does it cost to walk into the emergency room at Carl, like $1,000 for your walk-in fee or whatever, you know, it's going to be about a fifth to a tenth of that. But as with anything, prevention is what's going to save you money. Knowledge, come in early, don't wait. That is what's going to help to decrease the expense, you know, and decrease that cost. And not only in a financial sense, but also, you know, then in that emotional sense.
Okay. We're talking with Dr. Sally Foote, small animal specialist in Tuscola. And I should note that the website we were talking about earlier, the OCAW, vetclinic.com, you can find it by going to our website. Go to will.illinois.edu/focus. And you'll find a link to the website and all the useful pet information there. One thing we were talking about earlier that I wanted to bring up, I guess this is a more general question about pet food.
Mm-hmm.
And just thinking, all the pet food commercials I have seen in my lifetime that take different strategies of getting, of course, they're not really advertising to the pet.
No.
But most of the time they're advertising to the pet owner's either feeling of obligation and guilt as to whether or not they're treating their animal right,
yeah.
But also a lot of the time what they think the pet would really like to eat.
Right, right. Well, you know, pet food is, I mean, feeding your pet's important, and you need to feed your pet the right kind of food. And so it is always, let's put it this way, simplest statement, you get what you pay for. So in a very general sense, the more expensive or larger company, you know, food, say like IAMS, Purina, Calcan, at your grocery store level type food, are going to be a good quality general pet food. Now, there are some pets that may have specific health needs, and need to have a more kind of specialized diet. And that may be something that's either just on a prescription level directly through your veterinarian, or there may be some that are available, what we call like a premium diet, you know, through the pet stores and stuff that they can use. But again, you need the guidance from your veterinarian, because not all of them are really exactly the same. What we're seeing a lot now are these grain-free diets promoting to being, we're hypoallergenic, you know, or good for the skin. And while in the general term, we may want to avoid grain in some pets, not all those diets are really truly hypoallergenic and may not be as helpful for, say, a skin problem. So again, you need to talk to your veterinarian, or some of the technicians have gone through some training to be certified in nutritional consultation. And that's really the best place to get your information from.
And I know there's at least one brand of dog food that has long advertised itself as being virtuous because it is all meat, and therefore that is what dogs are built to eat. Are dogs built to be pure carnivores?
No, they're really more omnivorous, meaning a mixture, you know, of meat and grain and vegetable protein.
Because I don't know what dogs, you know, feral dogs or wolves, for instance, are eating besides meat.
Pretty much the whole carcass. So that's, again, when we say, like, the stomach contents, you know, of a deer is going to contain grain, et cetera. And that's how they're going to get their more of a balance of their amino acids.
They're not actually going out and doing any grazing on their own directly.
Not much. They may do a little bit, but not a whole lot. You know, it's normal. You will see your dog eating grass. And part of that is they're investigating the environment. And, you know, of course, we can't ask them. But anyway, they do have some need for fiber, and they do have some need for some of the nutrients and such that are contained in, you know, the grain, the grass type material.
So, but to what degree should it be in pet food? How much grain and vegetable material is enough? How much is too much so that it crowds out other nutrients?
You know, the pretty much the major companies are certified by the like nutritional board, and I'm sorry, I can't immediately recall the initials on it. But pretty much most dog foods for a healthy adult life stage, and that's the other good thing about the pet foods they have now. There's a stage for a puppy, stage for the adult, stage for the older pet, you know, et cetera. They're going to fall within like the 20 to 25% protein range, but it's really digestible protein, and you won't see that on the label. Again, that's what, you know, your veterinarian gets more of that technical information, with maybe about a 40% balance in carbohydrate for the dog and then fat, you know, making up the rest. And our cats, what we're really seeing is cats do have a much higher need for protein and lower need for carbohydrate. Like we really are finding it's much healthier for the cats and they don't get obese if we have a lower carbohydrate diet.
When you see a pet food which is promoting itself on grounds of nutrition, mm-hmm. for your dog or cat, what are you getting?
Well, you are getting a food that is made safe. It can be made safely and wholesome for your pet. And it does, you know, really when they come across and they say, like, we're better or we're the best, you do need to take that, I think, with a little bit of a grain of salt. You know, you really need to, again, discuss that, you know, with your veterinarian. Say, for my pet at this age, would this really be, you know, the better diet? Because they're not going to be saying across, you know, the television screen or the radio commercial, you know, that our protein level at 28% digestible is best for your pet. Well, if your cat pet had, say, kidney disease or some other kind of health condition that you don't want a lot of protein on, that would not be the best for your pet, you know. So, you know, they may be getting a good diet in general. But I don't think that any one particular brand of diet is going to be the best, you know, superseding all others.
And so there's nothing you can look for, like, say, in the ingredients list. Or I know they have nutrients list on pet food like they do for food that we eat.
Yes, they do. They're going to list the amount of, like, protein, fat, carbohydrate. And then, of course, they have the ingredient list, you know, on the side. And they will say whether or not they have met the standards of, you know, the certifying department of the government for being, you know, a quality pet food. But as I said, this is where that cost factor comes in, that you can go and you can see a very, like, generic type of pet food that says, oh, we're 28% protein and it costs, like, you know, $10 for a 50-pound bag. I mean, that's incredibly inexpensive and cheap. But the type of, you know, what's in that food and the protein that's in there can't be digested and absorbed. In other words, it's like made from the cheap grain, you know, and cheap stuff, compared to, say, going to the pet store and buying more premium quality food that's, again, 28%. Now, you might be paying $50 for a 50-pound bag, but that food is more, you know, digestible and going to provide actually more nutrition internally, you know, for that pet.
How much does it matter if the food is wet or dry?
Really, wet or dry is just one thing. Wet food is always more appealing. You know, it's more appetizing for dogs. It is better for the cats, actually, wet food compared to the dry food, because the wet food doesn't have as much of the carbohydrate in there. And so wet food, I'll tell clients, maybe give it like kind of as a treat, or if we need to coat a new dry food, especially with some of our prescription diets that may not be as tasty, you know, that to coat it with the wet to make it more appealing for them.
And I'm wondering about those pet foods, the fancy feast sort of things, mm-hmm. which which are really being aimed at being something that dogs or cats genuinely enjoy eating.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, a lot of them seem to enjoy eating just about anything, but but is it based, I mean, do they have flavor preferences?
Yes. Oh, cats sure do. Cats are much more finicky and picky about not only flavor, but also texture and the size of the particles, say if they are on a dry food diet. And so that is why when you go down that pet food aisle in the cat department, you're going to see like flaked food and pureed food and, you know, morsels and gravy kind of thing, because according to your particular cat, you know, they may prefer one more chunky versus pureed. And then sometimes too, like with our older cats whose ability to smell may not be quite as good, you need smellier food, you know. Some of the flavors just, boy, people open going, I can't stand the smell of it, but boy, this is what my, you know, cat will eat, and it's nutritionally sound. And so you say, well, good, we need something that's not only nutritionally sound, but something that they will actually eat. For the cat, boy, the act of eating is much more than just, gee, I'm hungry. It's all about smelling it, seeing it, getting it in their mouth, kind of rolling it around and getting the feel of it, and then swallowing it. And that's all based on their need to kill something every day.
And even though you don't let them do that anymore, there are actions that they can do with their food which give them some of that hunter satisfaction?
Yes, yes. Sometimes actually the food consistency and food texture itself does that. Secondly, putting small dishes of food, like even just a saucer with about a tablespoon of food, in different perches and places around the house where they actually have to go and hunt for it is another way that you can give them that feeling, I've just hunted and killed for it. Or lastly, putting the food in a food puzzle, which is like a toy, like a ball or even an empty water bottle, and the cat has to bat it around and knock it around just like they have to go catch their prey and get their food out, and then they eat their food that way.
Okay. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with more about pet care and answers to your pet care questions from Dr. Sally Foote. This is Focus on WILL. We're back on Focus on this Friday morning, live with Dr. Sally Foote, answering your calls and emails about pet care. The phone number is 333-9455. You can call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 if you're outside the 217 area code. That's 333-WILL or 1-800-222-WILL. And you can email us at will-talk, that's WILL-talk, at illinois.edu. We've been talking about pet food, and I guess one... I was struck by it was actually a blog at NPR.org called The Salt, which is a food blog.
Mm-hmm.
But it got into the idea of local food and locavorians, and mm-hmm. was extending this to pets. And apparently, in the New York City area, anyway, you can go get your locally sourced food for your pet, which I think involved both meat, but maybe even vegetables to a degree. How it was prepared, I'm a little unsure, but mm-hmm. that does bring up the question of maybe, well, table scraps as an idea of food which isn't quite from a can or a bag. Mm-hmm. And is there a role for that, or is it something that's just better to stay away from for pets?
Really, feeding the pet from the table is something you want to stay away from, and there's a couple different reasons. The pet foods, prepared pet foods, commercial pet foods, have for a long time been well, well made and well balanced for not only the amount of protein, fat, and carbohydrate, but a lot of these essential nutrients like selenium, vitamin E, and especially for our cats, taurine. Taurine is an essential amino acid for cats. If they don't have enough in their diet, they will have heart failure or go blind. So back, you know, in the old days, like 40, 50 years ago, there weren't as many commercial pet foods, and a lot of people just fed their pets strictly from the table, and we saw a lot more health problems in pets because of this, and also to obesity. We see more obesity from, you know, feeding from the table because, you know, a straight like piece of meat or food like cheese and stuff like this is much more appealing tasting because your pet's all excited for it. You think, oh, he must be hungry. So you feed them more and they get a lot of extra calories. So lastly, from a more behavior standpoint, when you're feeding, say, directly from your plate to your pet, then they think they're like equal with you. And especially with dogs, we want to make sure that the pet sees you as a leader in the home. And this can actually contribute to some problems with like food aggression or misbehaving. So while there can be some homemade type diets, or there could be a producer, somebody actually making and producing pet food, say more locally, you know, buying their meat source, grain, etc., for the pet food more locally. Hopefully that is being supervised by a veterinary nutritionist to the recipe and that it is balanced. And that's the problem we see. When pets are getting a lot of pet food, table food, they're not eating the pet food. And then we're seeing these other health problems arise up in them.
And there's also the psychological issue. It sounds like you're suggesting that if there is food coming from another source besides the bag and the can, that it shouldn't be seen to be coming from the human's table.
Exactly. Right. It should be in their bowl. You know, people ask, oh, it's okay if I give them some leftover vegetables. And yeah, that can be fine. But I say, you put that in the dog's bowl. Don't have it go from your table right down to him standing here. It gets begging, but then we can also, you know, have the dog sitting under the table and different things like this. It needs to be in his bowl. It's coming from you to the bowl, but not off the table. So this helps to prevent, you know, a lot of those more behavior problems.
We have a couple of calls lined up, and I'm going to go to line one to talk to Wally in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yeah, good morning. And, yes, I got the lesson well. And I'm familiar with some of the sleight-of-hand tricks you use to keep the dog from realizing where the food's actually getting into his bowl from. But what I had recently got something packaged at the meat market in which there was a bone in the middle of all this meat that was about the size of a donut, but squared. And then when he was done with it, he ate the middle out of it, and he enjoyed it for days. But I can't find any place in town where you could get decent bones for dogs. I mean, skip the artificial ones come from China or wherever. But can you get real bones around here anywhere for dogs?
This is a really good question. I am not specifically aware. Some of the more larger butchers, and I believe there's one on South Neal Street, the old-time butchers, may have bones. But I got to say a couple things about bones. First of all, the bones are not digestible. And when your dog is chewing on the bone, we do see things like broken teeth, the fragments, you know, of the actual bone as he's splitting it up and consuming it and swallowing it down. Do not get digested. And I've had a number of dogs that have had severe constipation and intestinal problems because they really like that bone and they really grind away and chew on it and, you know, get these pieces in them that can cause a lot of damage and problems. You're right. The rawhide bones, a lot of them have had recalls coming from China. And so, and dogs do like to chew on things. So how do we satisfy our dogs chewing? Honestly, I'm going to discourage you from giving your dogs bones. I don't even want to go into detail in some of these cases I've had to take care of with bone problems. So,
feed him live squirrels?
No. What you do is you get him some food puzzles. And food puzzles are not just the Kong toy. That's one. But these are, there's a couple, our main pet stores in town have one I call the Flying Saucer. And there's other ones like that that you can put as food kibble in. You can go ahead and put canned food in there. And you, when you twist him shut, he's got to knock it around and you know, untwist it and work and, you know, bite and chew on it to get the food out of it. So it relieves him. It gives him, you know, that chewing and I'm pulling it apart. And I'll just say it, folks, he's killing that toy and that's making that dog feel good. But it's safe. And we're not going to get problems of bone fragments and constipation, and I won't go farther than that. And it's safe for them. Because actually, too, the raw bones, too, you know, coming in from the fresh meat can have contamination on there with E. coli and salmonella as well. And that can infect our pets. So that's another, you know, from another health side of it, why I'm discouraging, you know, whole bone and that on, you know, use for your pet.
I've got a rubber bone that's got some holes in each end you can poke a treat into, and he likes that.
Yes, that's good.
He gets them out so fast that I don't get any peace. With that real live bone. It took that lasted him for 2 days.
Yes, I know, and I'm glad everything worked out. But
well, he didn't work on it constantly for 2 days.
Yes,
he'd put it down, and then he'd come back to it.
Well, this is where it's good. You could have a couple different kind of food puzzles to rotate. With your dog.
I'll have to keep my eye out for them. I know that the counters are full of them in the pet stores and stuff. So
yeah, and I do have on our website, we do have a couple videos showing how to even do some homemade food puzzles for your dog and that. So that can give you some variety.
Well, I have a couple of the improvised ones. One of them, I have a little wastebasket that I put a treat under and turn upside down.
Oh, good.
He learned to grab and tip that over, and
yep.
And he loves to chase a laser beam. Do you ever hear it? He just goes wild on a laser pen, but I've never heard of dogs doing that before.
Oh, yes, they do, and usually the herding dogs like that the best. Now, here's the tip with the laser beam or flashlight, chase for your dog and your cat, is go ahead and play with them, but periodically you need to drop, like a piece of the dog food kibble or a treat at the spot of the flash so he actually achieves his goal of what he's chasing and getting something. Because sometimes they get so worked up, so wound up, and they're not finishing or achieving a goal that it kind of gets them too crazy and too frustrated.
He tries to dig the spot out of the carpet.
Right. So this time, just, time it and toss a piece of kibble. So this way, now he'll grab the kibble and it'll help stop the digging because he got what he was looking for.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for being there.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let's go over to another caller here on line two. Tom in Champaign, good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi, good morning. Two quick things. One, I'm going to have to disagree with you about the raw bones. The key, though, is not to let the dog have the bone for days and days. That's, I think, where you're more likely to get the challenge. We give our dog raw bones, and as soon as the marrow is gone, that's pretty much when we pick it up and toss it out. So they don't have that opportunity to work it for too long. So that's just my opinion. The other one I wanted to mention, you kind of disparaged home diets. Since about 2000, we've been feeding our dogs a raw food diet. So in the evening, they get a specifically measured out portion of chopped chicken backs. In fact, I'm on my way to the store to pick up a mess of them today. We chop them up for each dog so they're, the right size, not too big. And then in the mornings, they get a meat patty. We take various kinds of ground meat. We chop up a whole mess of vegetables, combine all that, and put it into patties. And I tell you, it's very natural for them. It's what I think dogs were designed to eat. And in the since 2000, we had one beagle that lived to be 18 years old. And she could have physically gone on a little bit longer, but quite frankly, at 18, she was starting to lose her mind. And that's well past the normal lifespan of a beagle. And all of our dogs have been performance dogs and have been very, very healthy on that kind of a diet. The only thing I always want to recommend it to people is that it's raw, never cooked chicken bones, but always the raw chicken bones. So I just wanted to see what your thoughts are. I think we're a little bit in disagreement, but that's okay. I want to hear what you have to say about that.
Okay, well, Tim, I appreciate your call. And a couple of things I have to say. Being a veterinarian, of course, I'm going to see when there's problems. And just like, any individual person may never experience a problem. So for you, you don't see the problems, and I see the problems, okay? A couple of things to say is that whatever the source of the raw meat in that going into the diet is important. Salmonella, E. coli, of course, that's in our raw, can be in our raw meats, and it's usually from the processor. So if your place or wherever you're sourcing your raw meat from is, doesn't have a problem with contamination of E. coli and salmonella, that can help. But the taurine and many other essential nutrients are important in the diet. And this is where people, maybe you don't do this, maybe you have a good diet and actual recipe you follow to the T. But a lot of people get sloppy on this. And when they do, then the pets are deficient in essential nutrients. And what I see then is heart failure. And what I see then is blindness in a cat. And so that's why I don't encourage the use of these diets. Some pets, yes, have done well on these diets with people who follow very strictly. Now, on the raw bone issue, again, I see the problems. I see the pet coming in with fragments of bone in their stomach, fragments of bone in their intestine, constipated. We have to anesthetize them. We're doing surgery, etc. And so that's why there's lots of other ways to give the pet what they need, like calcium and magnesium, without the risk. And you've been, I'm really glad that your pets have not had the risk, but eating these bones, et cetera. But if you, you know, went to the College of Veterinary Medicine and sat in their emergency room or their internal medicine department, you would also be seeing some of the cases that come in on the raw food diets and consumption of bones.
So it sounds like you're saying that these, that working with things like raw foods and real bones can increase the risk. Although I would guess that if you are careful and attentive, you can bring that risk back down at least somewhat.
Yes, absolutely right. That's correct. But it takes more work from the person. It takes more work from the pet owner. And we are humans. What do most humans do? You know, they backslide on really, say, following a recipe to the T. If I can't get dicalcium carbonate somewhere, I'll just skip it in this week's recipe, okay? And, you know, oh, darn, we ran out of chicken from our locally sourced, you know, chicken producer. So I'm going to go to the grocery store and get one from the major big, you know, chicken producers, the mega farm producers, and that's where we have more risk of actual infection.
Okay. I want to thank Tom for his call and remind you that we still have some time for veterinarian Dr. Sally Foote to answer your questions about pet care. The number is 333-9455, area code 217, or call toll-free 1-800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And let's go to line three to say hello to Mike in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Thanks for this segment. Really enjoying the conversation. I missed some of it, and so you might have already discussed this, but concerning fleas, we have an indoor-outdoor dog and indoor-only cat, and we have never treated the cat, and we always use Frontline Plus on our dog, a large dog, Golden Retriever.
Mm-hmm.
And Frontline Plus was so good, we brushed him frequently, but never really checked down to the below the coat and so forth. And Frontline Plus failed. We got tons of fleas. We got a terrible problem, and so we got different products from our vet, and we've been treating our cat. Here's my question. We got a spray by Sentry for the furniture and drapes and carpet and that kind of thing, and they have a lot of instructions about vacuuming and then throwing away the vacuum bag.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I vacuum every day with two different vacuum cleaners, one upstairs and one downstairs. I can't be throwing away the bag every day, really. I'm wondering, and this may be just conjecture, you may not know the answer to this, but what do you think about vacuuming, taking the bag loose from the vacuum cleaner and spraying that carpet, furniture, drape spray in the bag and then putting it back on so you can use it more than once? I mean, these bags are $1 a piece. I'm going to be, you know, spending $150 on bags this month if I don't reuse the bag.
Okay. Great question, because really what you're getting into here is what we call environmental control. How are we going to control fleas in the home, fleas in the environment?
Yeah.
Understand the flea life cycle, first of all, and I think that'll help you to understand where vacuuming fits in and where we can get the money spent in the right way. So, quick little life cycle on the flea. We have a live flea, bites and sucks blood from the pet. That's what they poop out, I'm going to say it, the dried blood and their eggs every day. Every day that female flea is laying up to 100 eggs a day.
Oh.
And those eggs are on the coat of your pet, and then they kind of fall off all over the house like salt out of a salt shaker all over the house. And fleas bite any mammal with blood. So they bite your dog, your cat, and you. And so, but they go to whoever's like closest, all right? That's why they tend to go to the pets more, because they're laying on the carpeting, you know, they're laying where these fleas are living in the environment. So adult lays eggs every day. Those eggs take about 10 days to hatch into a larval stage. And from the larval stage, about another 10 to 14 days to go into the pupa stage. And this is a real hard shell-like organism, and then about another 10 to 14 days to become an adult. So this is why we might see one or two fleas, but in about a month, we may have a ton of them. Now, the house treatment products, they need to carry or have a growth inhibitor in there to really be any good in your home. I am not aware. You look on your Sargent label, and if it does not say the word Precor on there or IGR, insect growth regulator, all you're doing is killing the adults, and you have three other life stages in the home, and that's not really going to be very effective for you. There's a product your vet probably carries that most all vets carry. It's the VetChem product that has that insect growth regulator in there at the highest amount, and it's going to kill three life stages, but not the pupa. Now, vacuuming sucks up and gets that larvae and the flea eggs and the pupae out of the house. But and you have to, the throwing out the vacuum bags, because those things are real sticky and they stick to the lining of your vacuum bag and they'll hatch out in the vacuum bag. Now then, when you treat the house, if you've got the growth regulator in there, do your treatment, vacuum first, vacuum thoroughly everything. You have to do upholstery, you have to do hardwood floors, etc. Throw away the vacuum bag. Treat with the spray with the growth regulator in there and do not vacuum for 5 days, because you don't want to remove the chemical from the home. It's doing its killing. Right. Then you resume normal vacuuming. You don't have to do so much pitching of the vacuum bag, but you have to repeat the process in 10 days to 2 weeks, because that pupa stage is going to hatch out into adults. Remember, nothing kills a pupa. And you do the whole process again. And if people follow this plan, then they really pretty much, along with keeping both pets on your flea control, then we can get over the flea problem.
I see. I was just looking at the product that I have for the ingredients here, and it's made by Sentry, and active ingredients are pyraproxifen, ethoxyl pyridine, and permethrin, and N-octyl dicyclofatine, something, dicarbonate. It says it kills fleas, ticks, flea eggs, and flea larvae. Is it missing something there?
Honestly, the Precor brand of insect growth regulator tends to be the best. I'm not quite sure about that last product you mentioned on that label, if that, how effective that is at insect growth regulation. Everything else above that is only killing the adults. So, you know, you can Google online and see, does it match up with Precor or not? If it does not, then I would strongly recommend getting a product containing Precor and, you know, discuss with your veterinarian if you're not getting good environmental control. On our website, on the OCA Vet Clinic website, we do have an article on flea control and how to get control in your home. Okay. And you can refer to that, too, to help you with getting control in your home.
Very good. Okay, thanks very much.
Sure, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you. And let's go to... Line 4 and Glenn in Burr Ridge. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a 2-year-old poodle, and I'm trying to think. He's a miniature, and unfortunately, he is currently at like 23 pounds.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And we have cut, the food from the plate.
Good.
And my concern is, it's been about 3-4 weeks, and we're not. He primarily gets just the bag food, and some like fresh green beans. And
okay.
At night, he gets a little bit of cooked chicken, but only a tablespoon. At what point are we going to see him start dropping weight? Or he's been this heavy for over a year.
Okay.
And I'm kind of concerned, should we look at having, like, complete blood work done? Could it be like a thyroid, or am I just, I need to give it more time?
This is a really good question. How quickly should my pet lose weight? First of all, your dog is relatively young, and so the risk or likelihood of other, physical problems or metabolic problems making it difficult to lose weight are not highly likely, yet it is good to, screen for that. So I would start with a wellness exam from your veterinarian, or maybe your veterinarian was there, at the wellness exam and recommended losing weight. What you really need to do is to get a number or get an idea from your veterinarian exactly how much I should feed and make sure you're measuring that amount from the dry food. So
we're doing that.
Okay.
He gets like a third of a cup in the morning, half a cup at night.
Okay, and so you're leveling off the cup. We're not cheating. No heaping cup.
No
okay,
cheating.
good. The second thing I tend to see is the importance of exercise. a lot of times we're only focusing on cutting down the calories. And when you cut down the calories, the metabolism can sometimes slow down in response to that. So you don't get as much weight loss as you expect. So what I tell my clients is, even if your pet may go out in the yard, put a leash on your dog and take him out for at least, you know, it's like you or me getting into shape, starting off with like a 5-minute walk around the block twice a day, build it up to 10 minutes, build it up to 15 minutes twice a day, and get that exercise in for your pet. Or active play time, you know, meaning taking the ball and actually have your dog, you know, chase it back and forth in the yard for 10 or 15 minutes. And, you know, pretty much we're going to want to see on a dog your size maybe about a quarter of a pound weight loss per week. So bringing your pet in regularly to the vet just for a weight check. All of us vets offer that. The technician can just pull the chart, and then they can tell you how much they're losing and tell you whether that's the right rate or not.
Okay, great. All right, doctor, thank you very much for your help.
Well, you're welcome.
Thank you very much, Glenn. And that just about wraps it up for this edition of some pet care advice on Focus. Dr. Sally Foote, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on. We got some great questions.
And you'll find a link to the Sally's website, OkaVetClinic.com, at our website. Go to will.illinois.edu/focus. We welcome any additional thoughts you have on today's program on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Monday on the program, the world of recorded music used to be a world of vinyl phonograph records, and for some folks, it still is. In an encore program, we'll talk about the vinyl record revival with Chicago Tribune music critic Greg Kott, Jin Pelly, a staff writer at Pitchfork, and Jeff Brandt, who sells vinyl records at Exile on Main Street in Champaign. That's on Monday's show. Focus Today is produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of our Focus team, Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Mike Pritchard is our technical director today, and he's been handling your calls. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.